Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Matt Johnson, and I'm here today to talk with Laura Smith, a professor of art history at Michigan State University, about her new book, Horace Pula, Photographer of American Indian Modernity. Professor Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I thought that we might start because I think a lot of our listeners, this is the first time they've heard Horace Pula's name. And so I was wondering if you could just start by telling us a little bit about Horace Pula.
Sure. He was, he's recognized as one of the first professional American Indian photographers in the early 20th century. He was born in 1906 in Mountain View, Oklahoma. That's really close to Anadarko, southwestern Oklahoma. And picked up photography somewhat on his own and somewhat kind of mentored by studio photographers in these small towns in Oklahoma who kind of let him apprentice with them, and sometimes they passed on some of their cameras to him. And this all, I think, most of his really conscious effort at professional photography began in the late 1920s. And he photographed mostly portraits of people in his community. He's Kiowa. I didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Southern Plains Indian. through the mid-1970s, and then his health declined, and he died about 1984.
When did you first hear his name?
I heard about him in graduate school. I did my master's in art history at the University of Mexico, working under Joyce Szabo. Mm-hmm. And she had a class on modernism or modernity or American Indian modern arts, something like that. And he had just kind of come to national consciousness as a result of a touring exhibition sponsored or co-hosted by Stanford University that his daughter was involved with there. Did you have another question or you want me to go?
No.
Okay. So he had just been, this exhibition had been touring as probably one of the first where he came to national consciousness with his touring exhibition. And there was a catalog that came out. And so most people became familiar there. And so Joyce was showing his images. And I was just fascinated because I really hadn't seen photography from American Indian communities in this early 20th century period before. And they set up such a difference from a lot of the images from the 19th century or taken by Edward Curtis or somebody. So,
So what's the, when you first saw those photographs of Pula, what struck you in particular when you first saw them?
That they were pictures of Indians, I don't know, driving cars and airplanes, taking part in kind of popular culture, like playing with ideas about Indians that we see in movies, Indians wearing flapper outfits and engaged in 20th century culture is really kind of a very exciting, positive, vital period of time. Whereas I think most of the stories that I'd heard up to that point or seen in terms of visual imagery are more about, you know, Indians losing so much. And indeed they did lose a lot. But there was quite a ongoing resistance and vitality to cultures at the same time. So there was ongoing life to indigenous people, indigenous cultures. They survived. And I think that his work really helped tell the story.
Yeah. But, you know, what's fascinating about the book is that you try to, you know, situate him in art history, and you call him, you know, a modernist. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's really at stake? Why is it so important to call Pula a modernist?
Well, you know, I am an art historian and I am an Americanist art historian. So these, you know, this is kind of me speaking from that position and being focused on a need in art histories, either in surveys, in coursework, in scholarship, or in exhibitions, to really decenter our story, or the story that has been told about 20th century American art. And there is a story out there, a master narrative, as all of us learn to talk about. And we've been talking about this master narrative for a very long time. And for Indigenous artists, I think that that still continues to be an important conversation, to realize that there are multiple art history stories out there. They're not all focused on the same aesthetic concerns. Indigenous peoples who were completely positioned about in the early 20th century as kind of wards of the state. They weren't even citizens, many of them, mm-hmm. but they were going to be speaking and making art from a very different perspective from, you know, the European and American modernists that generally get focused on. So a lot of my interest is in how do we decenter that dialogue? How can we bring in more voices? how can we, you know, really look at the structures of that story that's been told and realize how it's excluded a lot of voices.
Yeah. I mean, for the listeners who might not be conversant in art history, what is modernist really meant for people who are classified as modernists? What does their work actually look like?
The story that really got codified, I guess, mid 20th century about modernist art or modern art, was kind of the story of the evolution to abstraction. So modernist art really, as it has been unified in the master narrative, it has a focus on abstraction and individual expression. So we're much more focused on the artist persona or psyche. Engaged and within his work and his personal expression. So those are the primary ways. It's really kind of art that is separate or disengaged from the mundane, the vernacular, the secular world, and becomes something of, you know, only concerned of really separate from mundane reality, mm-hmm. I guess, mm-hmm. or secular concerns.
Yeah, and what's in Pula's work in particular that would make him a modernist and kind of expand the definition a bit?
Some of the things I look at are the ways that he engaged his contemporary reality. Mm. He wasn't. He certainly is. Aware of his history, and aware of his legacy, his father being an important recorder of history in his community. I think that he is taking his camera to kind of continue that legacy, but also engage the contemporary moment. There isn't nostalgia always for the wars that were fought in the past or the achievements of the past, but mm-hmm. really looking to what's happening in his present. The other thing that I think that he engages, like a lot of people, everyone in the United States in the 20th century, was, you know, technology and industry, mm-hmm. and, you know, the transformations and ways of making a living. You know, the automobiles, Indians engaged automobiles at the same time that everyone else did. He loved airplanes. You know, the camera itself is a machine that he is using kind of within the legacy of his father, who I already mentioned, of, you know, recording histories, preserving memories. for the community. Mm-hmm. So I look at some of those ways rather than thinking about, you know, design or color or surface concerns that, you know, modernist painters were, that I think that there is a way that modern culture, that Pula gauged the modern experience of the country and culture with his photographs.
Yeah. And the time period that you choose is really perfect for telling this story, right? Because he lives between 1906 and 1984, and you really focus on a small period of his life between 1925 and 1945. You know, what's going on in that particular period that makes it so ripe for the story you're trying to tell?
There's a lot going on. I mean, I think that's another thing that I could have touched on as far as the transformations in federal policies. Mm-hmm. The New Deal policies that are much more pro-Indian. I mean, that by this time it's coming out in terms of studies that assimilation has failed in terms of a policy. And there's more emphasis on returning authority to tribal governments and providing support for the arts. supporting the arts as a viable means of making a living. And because of that, there is more attention, more support for groups of artists, more exhibitions of art that are coming out for the first time. You know, Indian art is being looked at as art and what we might say are problematic ways at this time, but it is a transformation for the period to be looking at Indian art as art and not as artifact or specimen to be studied. So those are some of the main things. There's, you know, Oklahoma, there it has the highest at this time population of Native Americans living in close proximity to each other. So a lot of them are engaged in making art and seeing what each other's doing, whether it's painting or beadwork or, you know, sculpture or any of the arts that are going on. So there's quite vitality, not just in visual arts, but in poetry and literature. And, you know, I have Pula also engaged. I kind of consider him a marginal figure. Mm-hmm. I don't see him, as I've learned from the family, as really anyone who had a leadership position, political or even within his community. But I very much see him as someone that's engaged, that's in support of and working with a lot more of the leaders, observing and documenting a lot of the political initiatives towards sovereignty, towards bettering the life of the people in his community, collaborations between leaders and senators at the time that are going on, that he's taking pictures of as a result of his brother-in-law kind of pulling him in, or his other brother and sister-in-law kind of pulling him into their entertainment business, vaudeville circuit, and him kind of, you know, being an important figure with that photographic eye.
Yeah.
On the margins of a lot of transformations happening in Oklahoma.
I mean, it's amazing how much he produces, and you know, in the book, when you look at all of his work, you describe his work as kind of part of a counter discourse or a cultural resilience. And so what's Pula resisting in this particular moment through his art?
To read Pula's work as a resistor, first of all, I have to say that acknowledge that we don't have Pula's voice, at least as documented. And so I'm working by inserting him into a context of resistance. And this is, you know, I'm not making this up, but I'm using a lot of research. I'm using the knowledge of what's going on in his community, what's going on in Native American politics at the time. And I'm also in line with a lot of the scholarship on early early 20th century photographers, and this realization for a long time of technology, of how it has put images of Indians out there for, you know, by 1920s for a few decades, and realizing that technology could be used to create a counter discourse, to create, to correct inaccuracies. And actually, even though I've kind of positioned photography within its kind of short history, there's a longer history of indigenous uses of mass media technologies through newspapers to also kind of create a counter discourse and correct inaccuracies or, you know, preserve cultural information or to, you know, put out other representations of people to, you know, they're very aware of some of the stereotypes and the misinformation and the negative imagery out there, whether it's in film, or whether it's in photographs or postcards or, you know, caricatures in illustrated magazines. I mean, they have access to all of this media as anyone else does. And so I'm, in order to read his images that way, I mean, that's what's going on. I'm inserting him into that context.
Some of the photographs are really beautiful that he makes. And I was wondering if you might be able to just describe one or two of the photographs. You know, what's really in there that's showing the resistance? Because I know that he, cars, for example, are in, you know, lots of different photographs. I mean, he's really capturing this amazing moment in time in a lot of these photographs. And they're just really beautiful pictures that he's offering.
They are. I mean, one of the images that I talk most about that seems to really set up this discourse of resistance is the one where it's actually the period of when he is in the Navy. Not the Navy, sorry.
Yeah.
The Air Force. Don't get my mixed up. and he's it's on a holiday, and his friend Gus Palmer has come into town and on a visit, and he set up a photo shoot inside one of the bomber airplanes, and his friend is holding a machine gun, and Pula is holding a camera. And they're kind of aligned visually. I mean, this, I think, is one of his most successful and complex images of layering of lots of dichotomies of modernity in terms of, you know, airplanes or Air Force or even concepts of soldiers here, as they're both wearing war bonnets, but also are wearing the U.S. Army uniforms. So, there's lots of complexities that he set up and, you know, placing his camera, as I'm reading it, you know, in line with a weapon, not so much in a, you know, mode of violence as one as asserting authority with the camera. And this is where, you know, I very much read him as, as conscious, I guess, of his impact in resisting inaccurate ideas of putting out there either more truthful or more noble portraits of, you know, his community.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about this book is it doesn't ever fall into the trap of what's, you know, authentic and inauthentic. Is you're really just capturing this moment that Pula and others are going through, and Pula is just, you know, capturing these people as they're going through this very difficult moment in the early 20th century as you talk about modernity and technological changes. And there's often just this mix of people in the way that they dress and their positioning in front of cars and airplanes and things that doesn't really show up in a lot of the depictions of Native Americans in the 19th century, right?
Right. Well, even in the early 20th century, there's quite a dialogue on whether you should include these signs of modernity or this kind of technology, mm-hmm. or exclude it. In one of the chapters, I compare his work to the painters, the Kiowa painters, and how they used his photographs. And a few incidents, as inspiration for their portraits, and eliminated some of those items like modern clothing or cars in the background and things like that, which kind of shows you kind of some of the diverse discourses that were going on related to modernism and Indians and their art, and whether they should, anything that was coded as Western or European at the time, mm-hmm. Should be eliminated. That they needed to draw only purely from this idea of the 19th mm-hmm. century past. So it is a complex time. I mean, there isn't, one authentic identity out there, and that's some of the problem in addressing this that I took up is the complexities of mm-hmm. anyone's identity. But somehow Indians aren't allowed to have a complex identity. They're supposed to just stay as they were in the 19th century.
I mean, one of the chapters I loved the most in this book was this chapter on postcards. Then Pula is using his photographs and putting them on postcards. And as a historian, when I think about postcards and depictions of Native Americans, I think about travel companies, who have these kind of very stereotypical depictions. And these postcards were just kind of a wonderful resistance to those sorts of images. And so why did Pula get in the business of trying to sell postcards?
I think that was, part, I think that is illustrative of who he mm-hmm. was studying under. I mean, he was working with studio photographers who were, taking pictures of Indians, going to the Indian fairs or the Wild West shows and taking pictures that they knew would be, that they mm-hmm. would be able to sell to the tourists, to the visitors. And I think Pula is certainly participating in that market. But his family will also say that he never really made that much money. So we have to look to, possibly other mm-hmm. motivations. And it probably speaks to his eventual appointment or unofficial appointment as the official photographer of the Anadarko Indian Expo as photographer, that there was a need to mm-hmm. take pictures, that Indian families also wanted pictures, that they participated as consumers in buying postcards and portraits of their families, the winners of contests, or the participants in some of the performances, the dances. So we don't always... There isn't always just a non-Indian tourist market when we talk about consumption of mm-hmm. images. And so I think he's again in service of his community, sometimes making some money, most of the time not. I also insert him into the context of this awareness of the power of mm-hmm. representation and the possibility of putting other ideas out there about what it means to be Kiowa and, you know, a leader, an important leader, important hero in communities. This was a time where, in this context of resistance that, that, you know, people were buying these postcards, and I'm talking about Kiowa people, to post in their own homes. And like, some of the important figure, historical figures that were still alive when Pula was taking their pictures. So, I think there are, you know, complex motivations there for why he did the postcards. And it is probably one of the most exciting parts of the book, because this is what's out there in terms of really finding vintage Pula images are postcards. And when I was beginning my research, I was finding them on eBay, and it was important to start, you know, collecting these to really see visually what he was thinking about when he was printing the images, because he really didn't print a lot of his work.
Well, you know, I wanted to give listeners just an idea of just how difficult it is to do the sort of work that you're doing, because, you know, Pula doesn't leave much of his, you know, much behind for you. Some of these photographs you have to, you know, gather up yourselves, as you just said, on eBay, right? He didn't leave anything behind that tells you about his, you know, motivations or, you know, his interpretation of his own work. So as an art historian, you know, how do you do that? How do you write about him without, you know, without this, you know, diaries and, you know, stuff that he's written down for you? You just have his photographs and that's it.
That is, thank you for recognizing that. That is one of the challenge. That is one of the challenges. And this book is full of a lot of work. I mean, I began in 2004, and the book just came out in 2016. So it is a long journey, and it very much began with his family. I mean, that really was key. I couldn't have. I suppose I could have done a book without them, but it really wouldn't have been, I don't know, relevant or that, that worth that much, I guess, in terms of getting their stories down. Although the family also has written their own stories, or Linda Pula in particular has published her own stories. And so I need to, that needs to be kept in mind as well, that there's growing publications on his work. So, you know, it was key to starting with interviews with the family. And then I was guided by Linda to other members of the community who, you know, knew of him, grew up with him. When I first started my research, there were some relatives still alive who are no longer alive that I was able to talk to, because his children were born, you know, 1940s. And that's just coming at the end of the period of time where I'm looking at his body of work, you know, from 1920, 1930, they weren't alive. And Linda was very, you know, keen on telling me before my time. I don't know how to answer that question. So I began, you know, educating myself on what I could find as far as Kiowa history, Oklahoma history, Oklahoma arts, that is a lot of our time in archives, in museums, meeting with other scholars who had focused in on Kiowa history. There really wasn't a comprehensive 20th century Kiowa history when I started. There were lots of people who had focused on various aspects of Kiowa history and culture, but I kind of had to pull a lot of pieces together because Pula's works engage so many different stories. I was also helped by a Smithsonian fellowship, guided by, you know, Raina Green and Candace Green, scholars out there, and being able to go to the National Archives and look at those records. And, you know, even within those files, of course, we have to be speculative of what kind of, what government officials are writing, but there are a lot of letters from Kiowa people themselves and photographs that are in these files that people haven't looked at, you know, in long periods of time. And they become important pieces to the story, not the last word on any story, but I think that anything can help kind of provide some light, whether speculative kind of fragments of information, or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this book is not just a biography, it seems, of Pula. I think in part because he left so little behind, but it's really a book about a community. My next question is how did you track down Linda and Robert Pula? They seem to be throughout the book that they pop up. How did you track them down?
When I first started, the only thing I knew was that I thought that Stanford had the images, so I started contacting Stanford. And Charlie Junkerman, who had collaborated with Linda on the show, and it was he who gave me Linda's contact information. And then I contacted her, spoke with her on the phone, and set up a time to come meet with them. The first meeting was in a hotel, a long day with a lot of coffee. And I was very, very inexperienced graduate student. My tape recorder wasn't working, so I was relying on pencil and paper, the old technology, to write things down as best I could at that time and get some ideas for next steps, which the next steps were to come back to Oklahoma, do some more interviews with community and family, and start digging into archives. The Oklahoma Historical Society has a fantastic collection of his postcards, and some of the other museums around had a lot of supportive material that was very helpful. And now,
was Linda surprised at that point that you wanted to write a book on her father?
You know, I haven't asked Linda what she first thought. I mean, she was very I should do that. What she first thought of me. I mean, she probably. I think she tends to be very generous. And with information, with conversations, and that's what I found with both her and her brother, who I had the most conversations with. So I can't speak for her. why me? Mm-hmm. There's certainly other people that she's engaged. If you want to do work on Pula, then basically you need to talk to Linda. So I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not the only one that's certainly written on him or engaged her. but I'm very, very full of gratitude that she did, that the family has been so generous with me.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to end just by asking you, what do you make of just the recent attention to Horace Pula? So not just your book, but also you mentioned the Stanford exhibition, that suddenly that he's garnering attention that he's never received before. What do you make of that?
Well, some of the recent work, I mean, it isn't, the Stanford exhibition was a while, it was 20 years ago now. But
sure, yeah.
The exhibition at the Smithsonian, which was co-curated by some colleagues, Tom Jones and Nancy Mithlo, who have also been engaged in helping to, digitize his images. And they worked with the family to dialogue with the Smithsonian, the National American Museum of the American Indian, to get a national exhibition done. so I think that has been the instigator of, a lot of the attention, and perhaps the publication of my book as well. I mean, there was also mm-hmm. a exhibition catalog that was out too. So, I think through a lot of these, collaborative efforts that, more attention is being given to him. and his work is becoming more well known. I mean, it has been in, boxes in the family's house, and we're kind of all working together to better preserve and, document for everyone's benefit mm-hmm. for his work to become more known.
Yeah, well, I hope it continues to become more well-known, because his work is beautiful and significant. And Laura Smith, thank you for being on the program today with me.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. The book is Horace Pula, Photographer of American Indian Modernity, and the author is Laura Smith. Please go out and buy the book.